were the penance bouts, where petty offenders from the Palace of Patience could volunteer for mismatch combat in exchange for reduced sentences or slightly improved living conditions. At present, a hugely muscled Nicovezzo, punishing hand, one of the Duke's own household guard, was handing out the beatings. The soldier was armoured in black leather, with a gleaming steel breastplate and a steel helmet crested with the freshly severed fin of a giant flying fish. Scales and spines scintillated as the soldier stepped back and forth under the bright sun, striking out seemingly at leisure with an iron-shod staff. The Nicovezzo stood on a platform that was small but rock-steady. A series of circular wooden flats surrounded him, separated by an arm's-length span of water. These wobbly, unstable platforms were occupied by about 2 dozen slender, grimy prisoners, each armed with a small wooden cudgel. A concerted rush might have overwhelmed their armored tormentor, but this lot seemed to lack the temperament for cooperation. Approaching the Nicovezzo singly or in little groups, they were being dropped one after another with skull-rattling blows. Little boats circled to fish out unconscious prisoners before they slipped under the water forever. The Duke, in his mercy, did not allow penance bouts to be deliberately lethal. Locke held his empty wine flute out for just a second. Conte plucked it out of his fingers with the grace of a swordsman disarming an opponent. When the Don's manservant stepped toward the liquor cabinet, Locke cleared his throat. "No need to refill that particular glass just yet, Conte. Too kind, too kind. But with your permission, my lord and Lady Salvara, I should like to offer a pair of gifts. One as a matter of simple hospitality, the other as a... well, you'll see. Grauman?" Locke snapped his fingers, and Jean nodded. The heavy-set man moved over to a wooden table just beside the liquor cabinet and picked up 2 heavy leather satchels, each of which had iron-reinforced corners and small iron locks sewn into their covers. Jean set these down where the Salvaras could easily see them, and then stepped back so Locke could unseal the satchels with a delicate key of carved ivory. From the first satchel he withdrew a cask of pale aromatic wood, perhaps 1 foot in height and half that in diameter, which he then held out for Don Salvara's examination. A plain black brand on the surface of the cask read, "Brandvin Osterschalin 502. Don Lorenzo's breath hissed in between his teeth. Perhaps his nostrils even flared, though Locke kept the face of Lucas Fairwhite politely neutral. 12 gods, a 502! Lucas, if I seem to be teasing you for your refusal to part with your goods, please accept my deepest—" "You needn't apologize, my lord." Locke held up a hand and mimicked the Don's gesture for shooing words down out of the air. "For your bold intervention on my behalf, Don Salvara, and for your excellent hospitality this morning, fair Doña, please accept this minor ornament for your cellars."
"Minor?"
The Don took the cask and cradled it as though it were an infant not 5 minutes born.
I have a 506 and a pair of 504s. I don't know of anyone in Camor that has a 502, except probably the Duke."
"Well," said Locke, "my masters have kept a few on hand ever since the word got out that it was a particularly good blend. We use them to break the ice in matters of grave business importance." In truth, that cask represented an investment of nearly 800 full crowns and a sea trip up the coast to Ashmere, where Locke and Jean had contrived to win it from an eccentric minor noble in a rigged card game. Most of the money had actually gone to evade or buy off the assassins the old man had later sent after his property. The 502 vintage had become almost too precious to drink.
"What a grand gesture, Master Fairwhite."
Doña Sofia slipped a hand through the crook of her husband's elbow and gave him a possessive grin.
"Lorenzo, love, you should try to rescue strangers from Emberlane more often. They're so charming."
Locke coughed and shuffled his feet. Hardly, my lady. Now, Don Salvara, please do call me Lorenzo. Don Lorenzo, what I have to show you next relates rather directly to my reason for coming here. From the second satchel he drew out a similar cask, but this one was marked only with a stylized A within a circle of vines. This, said Locke, is a sample drawn from last year's distillation, the 559. Don Salvara dropped the cask of 502. The Doña, with girlish agility, shot out her right foot to hook the cask in mid-air and let it down to the deck with a slight thump rather than a splintering crash. Unbalanced, she did manage to drop her ginger scald. The glass vanished over the side and was soon 20 feet under water. The Salvaras steadied one another, and the Don picked his cask of 502 back up, his hands shaking.
"Lucas," he said, "surely, surely you must be kidding."
4. Locke didn't find it particularly easy to eat lunch while watching a dozen swimming men being pulled apart by a Gerishti devilfish, but he decided that his master merchant of Emberlane had probably seen worse in his many imaginary sea voyages, and he kept his true feelings far from his face. Noon was well past, the penance bouts were over, and the revel masters had moved on to the judicial forfeitures. This was a polite way of saying that the men in the water were murderers, rapists, slavers, and arsonists, selected to be colourfully executed for the amusement of the revel crowds. Technically speaking, they were armed and would receive lesser sentences if they could somehow contrive to slay whatever beast they were matched against, but the beasts were always as nasty as their weapons were laughable, so mostly they were just executed. The devilfish's tentacles were 12 feet long, the same length as its undulating grey and black striped body. The creature was confined within a 60-foot circle of cages and platforms, along with a number of screaming, flailing, water-treading men, most of whom had long since dropped their slender little daggers into the water. Nervous guards, armed with crossbows and pikes, patrolled the platform, shoving prisoners back into the water if they tried to scramble out. Occasionally the devilfish would roll over in the churning red waters, and Locke would catch a glimpse of one lidless black eye the size of a soup bowl, not unlike the bowl currently held in his hands.
"More, Master Fairwhite?"
Conte hovered nearby with the silver tureen of chilled soup cradled in his hands. White-fleshed iron sea prawns floated in a heavy red tomato base seasoned with peppers and onions. Don and Doña Salvara were a peculiar sort of droll.
"No, Conte, most kind, but I'm well satisfied for the time being."
Locke set his soup bowl down beside the broached cask of 559, actually a bottle of lowly 50-crown 550 liberally mixed with the roughest overpriced rum Jean had been able to get his hands on, and took a sip of the amber liquor from his snifter. Even mixed with crap, the counterfeit was delicious. Grauman stood attentively behind Locke's hosts, who were seated opposite Locke at the intimate little table of oiled silverwood. Doña Sofia toyed unself-consciously with a subtlety of gelled orange slices, paper-thin and arranged in whorls to form edible tulip blossoms. Don Lorenzo stared down at the snifter of brandy in his hands, his eyes still wide.
"It seems almost sacrilegious."
Despite this sentiment, the Don took a deep gulp of the stuff, satisfaction well evident in the lines of his face. In the distance behind him, something that might have been a severed torso flew up into the air and came back down with a splash. The crowd roared approval. Osterschalin brandy was famously aged for a minimum of 7 years after distillation and blending. It was impossible for outsiders to get their hands on a cask any sooner than that. The House of Bell Oster's factors were forbidden even to speak of the batches that were not yet on sale. The location of the vintner's aging houses was a secret that was reportedly guarded by assassination when necessary. Don Lorenzo had been struck stupid when Locke had casually offered up a cask of 559. He had nearly thrown up when Locke had just as casually opened the seal and suggested they share it with lunch. "It is," Locke chuckled. "The brandy is the religion of my house. So many rules, so many rituals, so many penalties." No longer smiling, he drew a quick finger across his throat. "It's possible we're the only people in history to have an unaged sample with a lunch of soup. I thought you might enjoy it."
"I am."
The Don swirled the liquor in his glass and stared at it, as though hypnotized by the soft caramel-colored translucence.
"And I'm dead serious about what sort of scheme you've got up your sleeve, Lucas."
"Well," Locke swirled his own drink theatrically, "there have been 3 invasions of Emberlane in the past 250 years. Let's be frank. The succession rights of the Kingdom of the Marrows always involves armies and blood before they involve blessings and banquets. When the Grafs quarrel, the Ostershallin Mountains are only landward barrier and the site of heavy fighting. This fighting inevitably spills down the eastern slopes of the mountains, right through the vineyards of the House of Bel-Oster. How could it be different this time? Thousands of men and horses coming over the passes, trampling the vineyards, sacking everything in sight. It might even be worse now that we have fire oil. Our vineyards could be ashes half a year from now."
"You can't exactly pack your vineyards up and take them with you if you jump ship," said Don Lorenzo.
"No," Locke sighed. "It's the Ostershallin soils, in part, that make Ostershallin brandy. If we lose those vineyards, it will be just as it was before, an interruption of growth and distillation. 10, 20, maybe even 30 years, or more. And it gets worse. Our position is terrible. The Graf can't let Emberlane's ports and revenue go if the Marrows are coming to civil war. He and his allies will storm the place as fast as possible. They'll likely put the Black Table to the sword, impound their goods and properties, nationalize their funds. The House of Bel-Oster won't be spared. At the moment, the Black Table is acting quietly but firmly. Grau and I sailed 5 days ago, just 12 hours before we knew the port would be sealed off. No Emberlane-flagged ships are being allowed out. They're all being docked and secured for repairs or quarantine. Nobles still loyal to the Graf are under house arrest by now, their guards disarmed. Our funds in various lending houses of Emberlane have been temporarily frozen. All the Black Table merchant houses have consented to do this to one another. It makes it impossible for any house to flee en masse with its gold and its goods. Currently, Grau and I are operating on our local credit line, established at Maraggio's years ago. My house, well, we simply didn't keep our funds outside Emberlane, just a bit here and there for emergencies.
Locke watched the Salvaras very closely for their reaction. His news from Emberlane was as fresh and specific as possible, but the Don might have sources of intelligence the gentleman bastards hadn't spotted in their weeks of surveillance and preparation. The parts about the Black Table and the impending civil war were solid, educated speculation. The part about a sudden port closure and house arrests was pure homespun bullshit. In Locke's estimation, the real mess in Emberlane wouldn't start for a few months. If the Don was wise to this, the game might be blown. Conte might be trying to pin Locke to the table with his daggers in just a few seconds. And then Jean would pull out the hatchets he had concealed down the back of his vest, and everyone in the little group beneath the silk awning would get very, very uncomfortable. But the Salvaras said nothing. They merely continued to stare at him with eyes that plainly invited him to go on. Emboldened, he continued.
"This situation is unbearable. We will neither be hostages to a cause that we barely profess, nor victims for the Graf's vengeance upon his inevitable return. We choose a somewhat risky alternative, one that would require substantial aid from a noble of Camor. You, Don Salvara, if it is within your means." The Don and his wife had clasped hands under the table. He waved his hand at Locke excitedly. "We can surrender our funds. By taking no steps to secure them, we buy ourselves more time to act, and we are quite confident that replacing those funds will merely be a matter of time and effort. We can even abandon," Locke gritted his teeth, "we can even abandon our vineyards. We will completely burn them ourselves, leaving nothing to anyone else. After all, we enhance the soil ourselves, alchemically, and the secret of that enhancement is kept only in the hearts of our planting masters."
"The Osterschalin process," Sophia breathed, betrayed by her own rising excitement.
"Of course, you've heard of it. Well, there are only 3 planting masters at any given time, and the process is complex enough to defy soil examination, even by someone with talents such as yours, my lady. Many of the compounds our alchemists use are inert, and intended only to confuse the matter. So that's that. The one thing we cannot abandon is our stock of aging blends, the last 6 years batched in their casks, and certain rare vintages and special experiments. We store the Osterschalin in 32-gallon casks. There are nearly 6,000 such casks in our possession. We have to get them out of Emberlane. We have to do it in the next few weeks, before the Black Table imposes harsher control measures, and before the Graf begins laying siege to his canton. And now our ships are under guard, and all of our funds are untouchable."
You want to get all of these casks out of Emberlane? All of them?"
The Don actually gulped.
"As many as possible," said Locke.
"And for this you would involve us how?"
Doña Sophia was fidgeting.
"Emberlane flagged ships can no longer leave port, nor enter if they wish to escape again, but a small flotilla of Camor-flagged ships with Camori crews financed by a Camori noble."
Locke set his glass of brandy down and spread both his hands in the air.
"You wish me to provide a naval expedition?"
2 or 3 of your larger galleons should do it. We're looking at 1,000 tons of cargo, casks and brandy alike. Minimal crew, say 50 or 60 men a ship. We can take our pick of the docks and get sober, trustworthy captains. 6 or 7 days beating north, plus however long it takes to scratch the crews and ships together. I guess less than a week. Do you concur?
A week, yes, but you're asking me to finance all of this?
In exchange for a most handsome recompense, I assure you.
Provided everything goes well, yes, and we'll come to the matter of recompense in a moment, but just the rapid acquisition of 2 galleons, good captains, and very reliable crews.
Plus, said Locke, something to stick in the hold for the trip north. Cheap grain, dried cheese, low-grade fresh fruit, nothing special. But Emberlane will shortly be under siege. The Black Table will be happy to have a cache of extra supplies offloaded. Emberlane's position is too tenuous to fail to respect the sovereign neutrality of Camor. That's what my masters are counting on to get the ships in and out. But added assurance cannot hurt.
Yes, said Don Lorenzo, tugging on his lower lip. 2 galleons, crews, officers, cheap cargo. A small crew of mercenaries, 10 or 12 a ship. There are always some hanging around the Viscount's gate this time of year. I'd want a hard corps of armed men on each ship to discourage complications.
Locke nodded.
So how exactly would we go about removing the casks from your aging houses and transporting them to the docks?
A very simple ruse, said Locke. We maintain several breweries and storehouses for small beer. It's a sideline, a sort of hobby for some of our blending masters. Our beer is stored in casks, and the location of these warehouses is public knowledge. Slowly, carefully, while Grau and I sailed south, my masters have been moving casks of Osterschalin brandy to the beer warehouses and relabeling them. They will continue to do so while we prepare here, and until our ships appear in the harbor of Emberlane.
So you won't be loading brandy in secret?
Doña Sofia clapped her hands together.
As far as anyone knows, you'll be loading beer in the open.
Exactly, my lady. Even the large export of beer won't be anywhere near as suspicious as a movement of the unaged brandy. It'll be looked on as a commercial coup. We'll be the first to dodge the interdict on Emberlane-flagged vessels. We'll bring in a pile of supplies for the coming siege, and a fine apparent profit for ourselves. Then, once we've got all the brandy loaded, we'll put out to sea, bringing 60 or 70 Bell-Oster family and employees to form the nucleus of our new business operations in Camor. Discovery after that will be immaterial.
All of this to be thrown together on short notice.
Don Lorenzo was deep in thought. 15,000 crowns, I'd say. Perhaps 20. I concur, my lord. Count on an additional 5,000 or so for bribes and other arrangements.
Locke shrugged. Certain men are going to have to look the other way for us to do our job when we reach Emberlane, warehouse ruse or no.
25,000 crowns, then.
Damn.
Lorenzo downed the last of the brandy in his glass, set it down, and folded his hands together on the table before him.
You're asking me for more than half of my fortune. I like you, Lucas, but now it's time to discuss the other side of the proposal.
Of course. Lucas stopped to offer the Don another dash of the counterfeit unaged. The Don began to wave him off, but his taste buds prevailed over his better judgment, and he held out his glass. Doña Sofia did so as well, and Jean hurried over to pass her glass between her and Locke. When he'd served the Salvaras, Locke poured a companionably large amount into his own snifter.
First, you have to understand what the House of Bell-Oster is and is not offering. You will never have the Osterschalen process. It will continue to be passed down verbally and strictly within the house. We can afford you no properties as collateral or in payment. We expect to forfeit them upon fleeing Emberlane. Resecuring the vineyards at a future date is our own problem. Any effort on your part to pry into the Osterschalin process, to suborn any Bell-Oster men or women, will be regarded as an absolute breach of trust.
Locke sipped brandy.
I have no idea what specific penalties we could levy to express our displeasure, but it would be fully expressed. I am instructed to be entirely clear on this point.
And so you are.
Doña Sofia placed one hand on her husband's left shoulder.
But these limitations are not yet an offer.
Forgive me, gracious Doña Sofia, for speaking to you like this, but you must understand, this is the most important thing the House of Bell-Oster has ever contemplated. Grau and I hold the future of our combine in our rather vulnerable hands. At this moment, I can't speak to you just as your luncheon guest, Lucas Fairwhite. I am the House of Bell-Oster. You have to understand that some things are not on the table, not even by the most remote implication.
The Salvaras nodded as one, Sophia just a bit more slowly than Lorenzo.
Now, consider the situation. War is coming to Emberlane. Our vineyards and our properties are as good as lost. And without those vineyards, there will be no Osterschalin actually produced for only the Marrows know how long. 10 years? A generation? Even when we have the vineyards back, the soil will need years to recover. This is the way it has been 3 times before.
For many, many years to come, the only new Osterschalin available is going to come from whatever portion of those 6,000 casks we can move out of Emberlane, like thieves in the night. Imagine the demand. The price escalation.
The Don's lips moved unconsciously as he calculated. Doña Sophia stared off into the distance, her brow furrowed. Osterschalin brandy was the finest and most sought-after liquor known. Even the alchemical wines of Talvara, in 100 bewitching varieties, were not as expensive. A single half-gallon bottle of the youngest available Osterschalin was 30 full crowns at retail. The price went up sharply with age. With a surprise shortage, a fixed supply, and no new crop of Osterschalin grapes in sight?
Fuck them!
Said Conte, totally unable to help himself when the sums involved vanished over his mental horizon.
Beg pardon, Doña Sophia.
You should.
She drained her snifter in one quick, unladylike gulp.
Your calculations are off. This merits a triple fuck damn at least.
The House of Bel Oster, Locke continued, wishes to establish a partnership with you, based in Camor, to store and market Osterschalin brandy during our interregnum. In exchange for your assistance in transporting it from Emberlane in our moment of extreme need, we are prepared to offer you 50% of the proceeds from the sale of anything you transport for us. Again, consider the situation and the price of Osterschalin during a shortage. You could recoup your initial investment 10 times over in the first year. Give us 5 years, or 10.
Yes, Don Lorenzo fiddled with his optics. But Lucas, somehow, sitting here discussing the possible destruction of your house and the move to a city 500 miles to the south, you don't sound entirely displeased.
Locke used a particularly endearing wry smile he'd once practiced before a mirror glass for weeks.
When my masters grasped the essence of their current situation, some of them suggested we should have engineered an artificial shortage years ago. As it is, we are determined that we can turn a painful setback into a glorious return. Those 6,000 casks, sold at shortage prices over a number of years, we could return to Emberlane with a fortune that eclipses everything we'd be leaving behind. And as for your own situation,
we're not talking about hundreds of thousands of crowns.
Doña Sophia returned from her thoughtful trance.
We're talking about millions, even split between us.
It would be foolish to presume too much, but yes, there is the possibility that the sums involved could reach such figures. My masters are also prepared to grant one final compensation upon our successful return to Emberlane and the restoration of the Osterschalin vineyards. We offer your family a permanent stake in all Bel Oster operations thereafter. Certainly nothing close to a controlling interest, but something respectable. A 10 to 15% share. You would be the first, and, we hope, the only foreigners ever offered such an interest.
There was a brief pause.
That's a very attractive offer, Don Salvara said at last. And to think all this was going to fall into Jacobo's lap simply by default. By the gods, Lucas, if we ever cross paths with those thieves again, I'm going to thank them for arranging our introduction.
Well, Locke chuckled. I, for my part, can let bygones be bygones. Grauman might feel somewhat differently. And the fact remains that while I sense we may be shaking hands very soon, we still have to assemble our ships, sail north to Emberlane, and snatch up our prize. The situation is like a damaged cargo rope, unravelling down to a single thread.
He saluted the Salvaras with his brandy snifter.
It will snap.
Out on the water, the devilfish was victorious, and the guards rewarded it for its service by filling it with poisoned crossbow bolts. Boat hooks and chains were used to haul the carcass out of the center of the shifting revel. There was just no putting a creature like that back into the box once it had served its purpose. The monster's red blood mixed with that of its victims and slowly settled in a broad, dark cloud. Even this had a deliberate part to play in what was to come next. 5. Scholars of the Therin Collegium, from their comfortable position well inland, could tell you that the wolf sharks of the Iron Sea are beautiful and fascinating creatures, their bodies more packed with muscle than any bull, their abrasive hide streaked with every color from old copper green to storm cloud black. Anyone actually working the waterfront in Camor and on the nearby coast could tell you that wolf sharks are big, aggressive bastards that like to jump. Carefully caged, starved, and maddened by blood, wolf sharks are the key to the customary highlight of the shifting revel. Other cities have gladiatorial games, other cities pit men against animals, but only in Camor can you see a specially armed gladiator, a contrarrechiala, battle a live, leaping shark, and in Camor only women are allowed by tradition to be contrarrechiala. This is the teeth show. 6. Locke couldn't tell if the four women were truly beautiful, but they were undeniably striking. They were all dark-skinned Camori with muscles like farm girls, imposing even at a distance, and they wore next to nothing, tight black cotton shifts across their chests, wrestlers' loincloths, and thin leather gloves. Their black hair was pulled back under the traditional red bandanas and threaded with brass and silver bangles that caught the sunlight in chains of white flashes. The purpose of these bangles was a matter of argument. Some claimed that they confused the poor eyesight of the sharks, while just as many claimed that their glare helped the monsters better sight their prey. Each contrarrechiala carried two weapons, a short javelin in one hand and a special axe in the other. These axes had grips enclosed by full hand guards, making them difficult to lose. They were double-headed, with the expected curved blade on one side and a long, sturdy pick-head on the other. A skilled fighter usually tried to slash a shark's fins and tail to nothing before making a kill. Few but the very best could kill with anything but the spike. Wolf shark skin could be like tree bark. Locke stared at the grim women and felt his usual melancholy admiration. They were, to his eyes, as mad as they were courageous. "I know that's Cecilia de Ricura there on the far left." Don Lorenzo was pointing the women out for Lucas Fairwright's benefit, taking a break from more than an hour of rapid negotiations. "She's decent, and beside her is Agnessa, who carries her javelin but never ever uses it. The other two, well, they must be new, at least new to the revel." "It's so unfortunate," said the Doña, "that the Barangius sisters aren't out there today, Master Fairwhite. They're the best."
"Probably the best there ever has been." Don Salvara squinted to cut some of the glare rising off the water, and tried to estimate the size of the sharks, barely visible as shadows within their cages.
"Or ever will be. But they haven't been at the revel for the past few months."
Locke nodded and chewed on the inside of one of his cheeks. As Locke Lamora, garista of the Gentleman Bastards, and respectable sneak thief, he knew the Barangius twins personally. He also knew exactly where they'd been for those past few months. Out on the water, the first fighter was taking her position. Contrarrechiala fought across a series of stepping stone platforms, each about 2 feet wide and raised half a foot off the water. These platforms were set out in a square grid, 4 or 5 feet apart, leaving plenty of room for the opposition to swim between them. The women would have to hop between these platforms at a rapid pace to strike out at the sharks, while dodging leaps in return. A slip into the water was usually the end of the contest. Beyond the line of shark cages, opened by chain pulleys connected to a barge well beyond the periphery of any possible shark activity, there was a little boat, crewed by extremely well-paid volunteer rowers, and carrying the three traditional observers of any teeth show. First, there was a priest of Yono, in his sea-green robes fringed with silver. Beside him, there was a black-robed, silver-masked priestess of Azaguiya, Lady of the Long Silence, Goddess of Death. Lastly, there was a physicker, whose presence had always struck Locke as an extremely optimistic gesture. "Come o'er!" The young woman, apparently Cecilia Derricura, raised her weapons into the air over her head. The heavy murmur of the crowd subsided, leaving only the noise of water lapping against boats and breakwaters. 15,000 watchers held their collective breath. "I dedicate this death to Duke Nicovante, our lord and patron!" Such was the traditional phrasing of the Contrarecala's salute. This death could conveniently refer to either participant in the battle. With a great flourish of trumpets and the cheer of the crowd, the boatmen outside the circle of cages loosed the afternoon's first shark. The 10-foot fish, already blood-mad, shot forth from imprisonment and began to circle the stepping platforms, its ominous grey fin slicing a ripple line in the water. Cecilia balanced on one foot and bent down to slap the water with the heel of the other, screaming oaths and challenges. The shark took the bait. In a few seconds, it was in amongst the platforms, stocky body whipping back and forth like a toothy pendulum. "This one doesn't like to waste time!" Don Salvara actually wrung his hands together. "I bet it's an early leaper!" Barely had these words escaped his mouth than the shark rocketed up out of the water in a fountain of silver spray, hurling itself at the crouching fighter. The shark's leap was not a high one. Cecilia avoided it by jumping right to the next platform over. In midair, she let her javelin go with a backhanded cast. The shaft sunk into the shark's flank and quivered there for a split second before the streamlined mass of hungry muscles splashed back down into the water. Crowd reaction was mixed. The cast had displayed remarkable agility but minimal power. Cecilia's shark was likely only further angered and her javelin wasted. "Oh, poor decision," the Doña clicked her tongue. "This girl needs to learn some patience. We'll see if her new friend gives her the chance." Thrashing, spraying pink-foamed water, the shark maneuvered for another attack, chasing Cecilia's shadow on the water. She hopped from platform to platform, axe reversed so the spike was facing outward. "Master Fairwhite." Don Lorenzo removed his optics and played with them while he watched the fight. Apparently, they weren't necessary for use at long distances. "I can accept your terms, but you have to appreciate that my portion of the initial risk is quite heavy, especially relative to my total available funds. My request, therefore, is that the split of revenues from our Ostershalin sales be adjusted to 55-45 in my favor." Locke pretended to ponder while Cecilia pumped her arms and leapt for dear life, the eager grey fin slashing through the water just behind her feet. "I'm authorized to make such a concession on behalf of my masters. In return, I would fix your family's ownership interest in the resecured Ostershalin vineyards at 5%. "Done," the Don smiled. "I will fund 2 large galleons, crew and officers, necessary bribes and arrangements, and a cargo to take north with us. I'll oversee 1 galleon, you the other. Mercenary crews of my choosing to be placed aboard each vessel for added security. Conte will travel with you. Your Grauman can stay at my side. Any expenditures that bring our budget over 25,000 Komori crowns are to be made solely at my discretion." The shark leapt and missed again. Cecilia performed a brief one-armed handstand on her platform, waving her axe. The audience roared while the shark rolled over gracelessly in the water and came back for another pass.
Agreed, said Locke. Signed identical copies of our contract to be kept by each of us. One additional copy in Therin to be kept with a mutually agreeable neutral solicitor, to be opened and examined by them within the month should one of us have an accident while fetching the casks. One additional copy in Vadran to be signed and placed into the care of an agent known to me for eventual delivery to my masters. I shall require a bonded scribe at the Tumble home this evening, and a promissory note for 5,000 crowns to be drawn at Maraggio's tomorrow so I can get to work immediately.
And that is all that remains?
Quite everything, said Locke. The Don was silent for several seconds.
The hell with it. I agree. Let's clasp hands and take our chances.
Out on the water, Cecilia paused and hefted her axe, timing a blow as the shark approached her platform on her right, undulating, moving too slow for a high leap. Just as Cecilia shifted her weight to bring the spike down, the shark jackknifed in the water beside her, squeezing its body into a U-shape, and drove itself straight downward. This maneuver flicked its tail into the air, catching the Contra Ricciala just under her knees. Screaming more in shock than in pain, Cecilia de Ricura fell backward into the water. It was all over a few seconds after that. The shark came up biting and must have taken her by one or both legs. They turned over and over in the water a few times. Locke caught glimpses of the frantic woman's form alternating with the dark, rough hide of the shark. White, then grey. White, then grey. In moments the pink foam was dark red once more, and the two struggling shadows were sinking into the depths beneath the platforms. Half the crowd roared lusty approval. The rest bowed their heads in a respectful silence that would last just until the next young woman entered the ring of red water.
Gods!
Doña Sofia stared at the spreading stain on the water. The surviving fighters stood with their heads lowered, and the priests were gesturing some sort of mutual blessing.
Unbelievable! Taken in so fast by such a simple trick! Well, my father used to say that one moment of misjudgment at the revel is worth 10 at any other time.
Locke bowed deeply to her, taking one hand and kissing it.
I doubt him not at all, Doña Sofia. Not at all.
Smiling amiably, he bowed to her once more, then turned to shake hands with her husband.
Interlude. Locke stays for dinner. 1.
What?
Locke nearly jumped to his feet.
What are you talking about?
My boy, said Chains. My intermittently brilliant little boy. Your world has such small horizons. You can see clearly enough to pull a fast one on someone, but you can't see past the immediate consequences. Until you learn to think ahead of the repercussions, you are putting yourself and everyone around you in danger. You can't help being young, but it's past time that you stopped being stupid, so listen carefully. Your first mistake was that taking coin from the watch isn't a beating offence. It's a killing offence. Are we clear on that? Here in Camor, the watch takes our coin, and never the other way around. This rule is set in stone, and there are no exceptions, no matter what kind of thief you are. It's death. It's a throat-slashing, shark-feeding, off-to-meet-the-gods offence. Clear? Locke nodded. So when you set Veslin up, you really set him up. But you compounded this mistake when you used a white iron coin. You know how much a full crown is worth, exactly?
Lots.
Ah, lots isn't exactly. You don't speak Therin, or you don't really know.
I guess I don't really know.
Well, if everything's butter and nobody's been shaving the damn things, that little piece of shiny white iron was worth 40 silver solons. You see? 240 coppers. Your eyes are wide. That means you can think that big, that you understand.
Yes. Wow.
Yes. Wow. Let me put it in perspective. A yellow jacket, one of our selfless and infinitely dutiful city watchmen, might make that much for 2 months of daily duty. And watchmen are decently paid for common folk, and they sure as blessed shit do not get paid in white iron. Eh? So not only was Veslin taking money, he was taking too much money. A full crown. You can buy a death for much less, yours included.
How much did you pay for my...
Locke tapped his chest, where the death mark still hung beneath his shirt. I don't mean to prick your rather substantial opinion of yourself, but I'm still not sure if it was 2 coppers wisely spent. At the boy's expression, Chains barked out a rich, genuine laugh, but then his voice grew serious once again. Keep guessing, boy. But the point remains. You can get good, hard men to do serious work for less. You could buy 5 or 6 major pieces of business, if you know what I mean. So when you stuck a white iron coin in Veslin's things...
It was too much money for anything... simple?
Dead on. Far too much money for information or errands. Nobody in their right mind gives a fucking graveyard urchin a full crown. Unless that urchin is being paid to do something big. Kill your old master, for example. Smoke out all of Shades Hill and everyone in it. So if the poor thief-maker was upset to discover that Veslin was on the take, you can imagine how he felt when he saw how much money was involved. Locke nodded furiously. Ah, so. 2 mistakes. Your 3rd mistake was involving Gregor. Was Gregor supposed to get hit with the ugly stick?
I didn't like him, but no. I just wanted Veslin. Maybe I wanted Gregor to get a little, but not as much as Veslin.
Just so. You had a target, and you had a twist to play on that target, but you didn't control the situation. So your game for Veslin spilled over, and Gregor Foss got the knife too.
That's what I said, isn't it? I already admitted it.
Angry now? My, yes, you would be. Angry that you fucked up. Angry that you're not as clever as you think. Angry that the gods gave lots of other people the same sort of brain they gave Locke Lamora. Quite the pisser, isn't it?
Locke blew his little lamp out with 1 quick breath, then flung it in an arc, as high over the parapet as his slender arm could throw. The crash of its landing was lost in the murmur of the busy Camorri night. The boy crossed his arms defensively.
Well, it certainly is nice to be free from the threat of that lamp, my boy.
Chains drew a last breath of smoke, then rubbed his dwindling sheaf of tobacco out against the roof stones.
Was it informing for the Duke, plotting to murder us?
Locke said nothing, teeth clenched and lower lip protruding. Petulance, the natural non-verbal language of the very young. Chains snorted.
I do believe everything you've told me, Locke, because I had a long talk with your former master before I took you off his hands. Like I said, he told me everything. He told me about your last and biggest mistake, the one that tipped him off and got you sent here. Can you guess what it might have been?
Locke shook his head.
Can't or won't?
I really don't know.
Locke looked down.
I hadn't actually thought about it.
You showed other kids in streets the white iron coin, didn't you? You had them help you look for it. You let some of them know what it might be used for, and you ordered them not to talk about it. But what did you, back that order up with?
Locke's eyes widened. His pout returned, but his petulance evaporated.
They hated Veslin, too. They wanted to see him get it.
Of course. Maybe that was enough for one day. But what about later? After Veslin was dead, and Gregor was dead, and your master had had a chance to cool down some and reflect on the situation? What if he started asking questions about a certain Lamora boy? What if he took some of your little boon companions from streets and asked them nicely if Locke Lamora had been up to anything unusual, even for him? Oh, the boy winced. Oh. Oh, ho, ho! Chains reached out and slapped the boy on the shoulder. Enlightenment! When it comes like a brick to the head, doesn't it?
I guess.
So, said Chains, now you see where everything went wrong. How many boys and girls are in that little hill, Locke? 100, 120, more? How many do you really think your old master could handle if they turned on him? 1 or 2, no problem, but 4, 8, all of them?
We never thought about it.
Because he doesn't rule his graveyard by logic, boy. He rules it by fear. Fear of him keeps the older sprats in line. Fear of them keeps little shits like you in line. Anything that undermines that fear is a threat to his position. Enter Locke Lamora waving the idiot flag and thinking himself so much cleverer than the rest of the world.
I don't think I'm cleverer than the rest of the world.
You did until 3 minutes ago. Listen, I'm a garista. It means I run a gang, even if it's just a small one. Your old master is a garista, too. The garista of Shades Hill. And when you mess with a leader's ability to rule his gang, out come the knives. How long do you think the thief-maker could control Shades Hill if word got around of how you played him so sweetly? How you jerked him around like a kitten on a chain? He would never have real control over his orphans ever again. They'd push and push until it finally came to blood.
And that's why he got rid of me? But what about streets? What about the ones that helped me get Veslin?
Good questions. Easily answered. Your old master takes orphans in off the streets and keeps them for a few years. Usually he's through with them by the time they're 12 or 13. He teaches them the basics. How to sneak thief and speak the cant and mix with the right people. How to get along in a gang and how to dodge the noose. When he's through with them, he sells them to the bigger gangs, the real gangs. You see? He takes orders. Maybe the grey faces need a second-story girl. Maybe the Arsenal boys want a mean little bruiser. It's a great advantage to the gangs. It brings them suitable new recruits that don't need to have their hands held.
That I know. That's why he sold me to you.
Yes, because you're a very special case. You have profitable skills, even if your aim so far has been terrible. But your little friends in streets, did they have your gifts? They were just regular little coat charmers, simple little teasers. They weren't ripe. Nobody would give a penny for them except slavers, and your old master has one sad old scrap of real conscience. He wouldn't sell one of you to the crimpers for all the coin in Camor.
So what you're saying is he had to do something to all of us that knew about the coin, all of us that could figure it out or tell about it, and I was the only one he could sell.
Correct. And as for the others, well, Chains shrugged. It'll be quick. 2, 3 weeks from now, nobody'll even remember their names. You know how it goes in the hill.
I got them killed?
Yes. Chains didn't soften his voice. You really did.
As surely as you tried to hurt Veslin, you killed Gregor and 4 or 5 of your little comrades into the bargain.
Shit!
Do you see now what consequences really are? Why you have to move slowly, think ahead, control the situation? Why you need to settle down and wait for time to give you sense to match your talent for mischief? We have years to work together, Locke. Years for you and my other little hellions to practice quietly. And that has to be the rule if you want to stay here. No games, no cons, no scams, no anything except when and where I tell you. When someone like you pushes the world pushes back. Other people are likely to get hurt. Am I clear? Locke nodded. Now. Chains snapped his shoulders back and rolled his head from side to side. There was a series of snaps and cracks from somewhere inside him. Ah. Do you know what a death offering is?
No.
It's something we do for the benefactor. Not just those of us who are initiates of the 13th. Something all of us crooks do for one another. All the right people of Camorre. When we lose someone we care about, we get something valuable and we throw it away. For real, you understand. Into the sea, into a fire, something like that. We do this to help our friends on their way to what comes next. Clear so far?
Yeah, but my old master...
Oh, he does it, trust me. He's a wretched miser, and he always does it in private, but he does it for each and every one of you he loses. Figures he wouldn't tell you about it, but here's the thing. There's a rule that has to be followed with the offering. It can't be given willingly, you understand? It can't be something you already have. It has to be something you go out and steal from someone else, special, without their permission or their, complicity. Get me? It has to be genuine theft.
Sure.
Father Chains cracked his knuckles. You're going to make a death offering for every single boy or girl you got killed, Locke. One for Veslin, one for Gregor, one for each of your little friends in streets. I'm sure I'll know the count in just a day or two.
But I... they weren't...
Of course they were your friends, Locke. They were your very good friends. Because they're going to teach you that when you kill someone, there are consequences. It is one thing to kill in a duel, to kill in self-defense, to kill for vengeance. It is another thing entirely to kill simply because you are careless. Those deaths are going to hang over your head until you're so careful you make the saints of Perelandro weep. Your death offering will be 1,000 full crowns per head. All of it properly stolen by your own hand.
But I... What? 1,000 crowns? Each? 1,000?
You can take that death mark off your neck when you offer up the last coin of it, and not a moment sooner.
But that's impossible. It'll take forever.
It'll take years. But we're thieves, not murderers, here in my temple. And the price of your life with me is that you must show respect for the dead. Those boys and girls are your victims, Locke. Get that through your head. This is something you owe them before the gods, something you must swear to by blood before you can stay. Are you willing to do so? Locke seemed to think for a few seconds. Then he shook his head as though to clear it, and nodded. Then hold out your left hand. As Locke did so, Chains produced a slender, blackened steel stiletto from within his robe, and drew it across his own left palm.
Then, holding Locke's outstretched hand firmly, he scratched a shallow, stinging cut between the boy's thumb and index finger. They shook hands firmly until their palms were thick with mingled blood. "Then you're a gentleman bastard, like the rest of us. I'm your garista, and you're my pezon, my little soldier. I have your oath in blood to do what I've told you to do, to make the offerings for the souls of the people you've wronged."
"I'll do it," Locke said.
"Good. That means you can stay for dinner. Let's get down off this roof."
2. Behind the curtained door at the rear of the sanctuary, there was a grimy hall leading to several grimy rooms. Moisture and mould and poverty were on abundant display. There were cells with sleeping pallets, lit by oiled paper lamps that gave off a light the colour of cheap ale. Scrolls and bound books were scattered on the pallets. Robes in questionable states of cleanliness hung from wall hooks.
"This is unnecessary nonsense." Chains gestured to and fro as he led Locke into the room closest to the curtained door, as though showing off a palace. "Occasionally we play host to a tutor or a travelling priest of Perelandro's order, and they have to see what they expect."
Chain's own sleeping pallet, for Locke saw that the wall manacles in the other room could surely reach none of the other sleeping chambers back here, was set atop a block of solid stone, a sort of heavy shelf jutting from the wall. Chains reached under the stale blankets, turned something that made a metallic clacking noise, and lifted his bed up as though it were a coffin lid. The blankets turned out to be on some sort of wooden panel with hinges set into the stone. An inviting golden light spilled from within the stone block, along with the spicy smells of high-class Kamori cooking. Locke knew that aroma only from the way it drifted out of the Alchigrante district or down from certain inns and houses.
"In you go!"
Chains gestured once again, and Locke peeked over the lip of the stone block. A sturdy wooden ladder led down a square shaft, just slightly wider than Chains' shoulders. It ended about 20 feet below, on a polished wood floor.
"Don't gawk! Climb!"
Locke obeyed. The rungs of the ladder were wide and rough and very narrowly spaced. He had no trouble moving down it, and when he stepped off, he was in a tall passage that might have been torn out of the Duke's own tower. The floor was indeed polished wood, long, straight, golden-brown boards that creaked pleasantly beneath his feet. The arched ceiling and the walls were entirely covered with a thick, milky golden glass that shone faintly, like a rainy season sun peeking out from behind heavy clouds.